This is the weekly podcast from the Journal of Neurosurgery. This is the August 22, 2014 podcast from the Journal of Neurosurgery. My name is Natalie Pynchon, and I will be reading summaries of articles on vascular disorders, stereotactic radiosurgery, interventional neurosurgery, and oncology, published today. Gamma knife surgery for incidental cerebral arteriovenous malformations, a clinical article by Chun Po Yen and colleagues. A relatively benign natural course of unruptured cerebral arteriovenous malformations has recently been recognized. The decision to treat incidentally found arteriovenous malformations has been questioned. This study aimed to evaluate the long-term imaging and clinical outcomes of patients with asymptomatic, incidentally discovered arteriovenous malformations treated with gamma knife surgery. 31 patients with incidentally diagnosed arteriovenous malformations underwent gamma knife surgery between 1989 and 2009. The median nidus volume was 3.2 cubic centimeters, and the median margin dose was 20 gray. The mean clinical follow-up duration was 78 months. Following gamma knife surgery, 61% of the patients had complete obliteration of the arteriovenous malformation on angiography. In 23% of patients, no flow voids were observed on magnetic resonance imaging, but angiographic confirmation was unavailable. In the remaining 16% of patients, the arteriovenous malformations remained patent. Two patients had symptomatic radiation-induced changes, which manifested as seizure in one patient and focal neurological deficit in another patient. Two patients had one hemorrhage during the latency period of 116.5 risk years, yielding an annual post-radiosurgical hemorrhage rate of 1.7%. Thus, gamma knife surgery achieved a reasonable outcome with low procedure-related morbidity in patients with incidental arteriovenous malformations, and the benefits and risks of radiosurgical intervention will only be fully defined with long-term follow-up. Single-center experience with a dual microcatheter technique for the endovascular treatment of wide-necked aneurysms. A clinical article by Christopher Robert Durst and co-authors. The endovascular treatment of wide-necked aneurysms can be technically challenging. Coiling with a single microcatheter may lead to distal coil migration or impingement of the parent vessel, while the use of adjunct devices imparts additional risk and often the need for lifelong antiplatelet therapy. However, using a dual microcatheter technique, it is possible to successfully treat wide-necked aneurysms without the use of balloons, stents, or flow diverters. The dual microcatheter technique calls for the use of two microcatheters within the aneurysm sac. The coils can then be deployed sequentially by placing a framing coil through one microcatheter, followed by a second coil through the other microcatheter to lock the framing coil in place. Alternatively, the coils may be deployed concurrently to interweave and thereby stabilize the coils across the wide neck of the aneurysm. The dual microcatheter technique was successful in 91% of cases, with a morbidity of 1% and mortality of 2%. Clinical outcomes were excellent in 93% of the cases. The rate of retreatment following dual microcatheter aneurysm embolization was 18%. Given these results, it is the author's opinion that the dual microcatheter technique may be a safe and efficacious first line of treatment for wide-necked aneurysms. Controlled transient hypercapnia, a novel approach for the treatment of delayed cerebral ischemia after subarachnoid hemorrhage, a clinical article by Thomas Westermeyer and co-authors. This article reports on a clinical study that investigated whether changes in arterial carbon dioxide concentration can increase cerebral blood flow in patients who have suffered poor-grade subarachnoid hemorrhage. Once a day, the respiratory minute volume was gradually reduced to produce hypercapnia in 6 mechanically ventilated patients between days 4 and 14 after subarachnoid hemorrhage. During these interventions, cerebral blood flow and brain tissue oxygenation reproducibly increased. Increases of intracranial pressure were buffered by continuous CSF drainage. The results indicate that the manipulation of this basic regulatory mechanism might be used for the treatment of poor-grade subarachnoid hemorrhage patients. Neurosurgical management of a giant choloid cyst with atypical clinical and radiological presentation. A case report by Joel Woodley Cook and colleagues. The finding of a choloid cyst on neuroimaging is often incidental. These lesions are usually located at the foramen of Monroe, are hyperdense on CT scans, and generally demonstrate the signal intensity of water on MR images, although this depends on their content. When symptomatic, they frequently present with headaches and nausea due to an obstructive hydrocephalus. The authors describe a case of a giant choloid cyst in a patient presenting with complete left-sided vision loss and progressive memory loss, two very atypical findings in choloid cyst presentation. On MR images, this choloid cyst measured approximately 8 centimeters. It was predominantly T2 hypointense, T1 hyperintense, and contained an enhancing nodule. The differential diagnosis at the time of imaging included craniopharyngioma, ependymoma, neuroenteric cyst, teratoma, cystic intraventricular cavernous malformation, and a large choloid cyst. A left frontal craniotomy demonstrated a lesion arising from the third ventricle with a very tough wall that contained an anchovy paste-like substance. The histopathological investigation was of utmost importance in the final diagnosis of a choloid cyst. To the author's knowledge, this choloid cyst is larger than any other described in the literature. Thank you for listening. To read all the articles published by the Journal of Neurosurgery this week, or to listen to more podcasts, please visit us at thejns.org.